I'm Chris Farrell, and this is On Watch. Welcome to On Watch, everybody, the Judicial Watch podcast, where we go behind the headlines, take a deep dive on some news that the mainstream media doesn't really want you to know about. We try to recover some lost history and explain the inexplicable. Today, you're going to get your last warning. It's the last warning to the West. And Last Warning to the West is a book written by Dr. Shea Bradley Farrell. And we're going to welcome Dr. Bradley Farrell to On Watch. Welcome.
Thank you, Chris. Merry Christmas. Thank you for having me.
Merry Christmas to you. You've written a book, Last Warning to the West, that sounds kind of ominous.
Mm-hmm.
Carrie Lake wrote the foreword to the book.
That's right.
Congratulations. That's pretty cool to have
Thank
somebody
you.
Like that write the foreword. But in the opening, she says, you now have in your hands one of the last warnings we may ever get concerning the slow motion collapse of America's Democratic Republic.
Yeah.
That's heavy duty stuff.
It is heavy duty because it's true. And if I could point out also, I was very blessed with endorsements. Carrie Lake, as you said, wrote the foreword, but I've also got endorsements on the back cover by Lou Dobbs, Tucker Carlson, Representative Paul Gosar, General Michael Flynn, and,
That's an all-star lineup of folks.
All-star lineup, but they also are concerned about the decline of America.
So the subtitle of your book is Hungary's Triumph Over Communism and the Woke Agenda, which leads me to believe or understand that you're using Hungary as sort of a lesson or an example that serves as a warning to the U.S.
Yeah, I started going to Hungary doing research, trying to uncover why they held so fast onto their own national identity and sovereignty within the European Union, because they're this little small country, 10 million people, that says no to the woke agenda of the European Union constantly.
And they're landlocked, which makes it even tougher for them economically.
That's right. That's exactly right. And the thing is Prime Minister Viktor Orban of Hungary, and Hungary itself, has catapulted to the world stage because the Biden administration hates them. The European Union, they're like the thorn in the European Union's flesh. And it's this little country changing the way the world works because they hold fast to their traditions.
Everything I see on news media, not everything, but a big chunk of what you read on news media, says Hungary and Orban, it's authoritarian, it's some kind of a police state, and they don't respect human rights, and they're racist, and they're homophobic, and every other ism and whatever you want to call it. Is that a fair characterization of Hungary?
Not at all. I've spent months and months in Hungary, and it's a free country, a country that respects human rights, that respects also God, family, and their homeland. And that is exactly why the left is pushing back against them, talks about them as if they're authoritarian. I always say to my conservative friends, what is the leftist media saying about you right now? Oh, that I'm a domestic terrorist and that I'm authoritarian. I'm like, yeah, right. Is that true? No. Okay. Well, they're doing it to Hungary as well.
Right.
But
right.
Here's the thing, Chris. The reason I wrote the book for Americans is that Hungarians were telling me repeatedly that the rhetoric coming out of the United States reminded them of their Soviet era. They were occupied by the Soviet Union from 1945 to 1991. And this progressivism in the U.S., the woke agenda, is exactly out of the playbook of the communists.
So you come at this. I mean, this is an interesting combination. I've read every word of this book, and this is history, this is policy, it's economics. There's a lot of different stuff in here. But you're not a historian. I mean, you've got a PhD in international development or political economy. It can be described a few different ways. PhD from Tulane, international development, that was your professional background.
Yeah.
How did you get yourself around to be doing a political history of a country in Central Europe? Give us a
context. It's a great question, and it really parallels with what happened to me when I came to D.C. 7 years ago. I came here to work in a large organization for international development, but being in D.C. and seeing what was going on in Congress and the politics in the city, I realized Americans, as Reagan says, were about one generation away from losing our freedoms. And so I had to get into the fight. I had to get into the conservative movement. I never intended to be a conservative leader, ever. I was content going to Africa and the Middle East, helping communities to develop economically. But that's where it really began. And when I went to Hungary and started looking at the way that they push back on the European Union, I realized you can't tell the story unless you know Hungary's history. Because the reason they are so much better than we are at pushing back against the woke agenda is because they remember what it's like not to be free. You know, communism for 46 years, that wasn't their choice. They're a Christian, family-oriented, God, national sovereignty nation. The year before the communists came in, they were occupied by the Nazis. And you go back centuries to about 1,100 years ago, when Hungary first became a Christian nation. They've had to fight against the Ottoman Turks coming in and occupying, the Habsburg Empire coming in and occupying. They really get what it's like to not be able to choose their own destiny.
People are remarkably historically ignorant.
Yeah.
And so when you say something like Ottoman Empire, I think, you know, probably three-quarters of the viewing or listening audience is, what? I mean, they just don't know. They don't understand what that is. So was that tough? Was that tough to take lessons from whether it's 800 years ago or 300 years ago and to show their relevance now? Was that a tough job?
It was terribly tough. But you know what? I found things even as far back as the Ottoman Turks. You know, when the Ottomans came in and occupied Hungary, one of the things that was interesting to me is that no matter how long that they were there, Hungary never became Islamic. They never turned away from Christianity. It's very interesting. They also maintained some separation from the ruling of the Ottomans in locally, where they could make their own decisions. Mm-hmm. It shows the national identity and survival of the Hungarians.
So let me ask you, you just said national identity. Mm-hmm. So for some people, that expression is a dirty word. Mm-hmm. People that will say, well, you said national identity, or you talked about nationalism. That's secret language. That's some kind of crypto way of talking about Nazi stuff or white supremacy, or there's people that will just jump off a ledge if you say nationalism or national identity. How do you distinguish those things between the sort of the hysterical rhetoric of the left and then an actual, like, legitimate explanation of what those things are? Distinguish those for us.
Okay. It's definitely a problem you have to talk to people about. You have to go to the root of the word and the meaning, the root hearts of people in a country. So what nationalism really is it means we share the same culture, the same maybe religion, the same law processes, the same economic processes, the same traditions, and we all get together and we decide we're going to act as a unit. And, you know, Sir Roger Scruton, who was one of the greatest conservatives of our era, said that you have to have nationalism for democracy. And the reason that is nationalism brings everybody together like this to make decisions, and it keeps the power out of one group or one person's hands, because we are united in this nationalism. And if you take that a step further into countries all around the world, national sovereignty is each country, you know, abiding and getting along with each other, hopefully, not always, but each country respecting their own national identity and other countries respecting that country has the power, has the sovereignty to make their own decisions, such as Hungary within the European Union.
So you can be patriotic and not be some wild-eyed
fascists
or some other reckless. I mean, like, Canadians can be happy that they're Canadians.
Of course.
They don't have to just think of themselves as, like, you know, junior Americans or something. They have a distinct identity.
Yes, and I do want to say this. Nationalism can be perverted and twisted into something evil, just like anything can be. That's what Hitler did with the idea of nationalism.
Right.
Ironically, nationalism also is like the Achilles heel of fascism or of communism, because when people are proud of who they are, they're not going to fall under somebody else's rule, you know, under the Soviet Union, under Hitler. So Hitler and Stalin both found themselves beating back nationalistic uprisings in the countries that they were trying to occupy.
Right.
So it can be twisted, certainly. But you know what? I grew up with a Marine Corps officer, a pilot, a Vietnam vet who had been shot down, spent weeks in a coma, said he was never going to be able to have children. And then, you know, I was already born, but my brother and sister came along after that. So he was fine, praise to the Lord. But the idea of patriotism and nationalism was a really wonderful thing, and it still is. So when I find out, you know, that people are afraid of nationalism, I understand about the toxicity
right.
from Hitlerism. I
right.
understand that, but he didn't get to own nationalism.
Right. And I think the interesting thing is that when you look at the phenomenon between fascism in the form of Nazi Germany and communism in its manifestation, original form in the Soviet Union, actually the commonality between both of those ideologies mm-hmm. and both of those forms of government is actually socialism.
Yeah,
and you talk about that in your book, that the root, they're basically opposite sides of the same coin, really.
They are.
So maybe talk about that a little bit. Explain the differentiation between, you know, they're both horrible, but they have the same root.
That's right, and we'll talk about this, but remind me to go back and talk about the communist psychological warfare
sure.
points that remind me of America today,
I
and
will.
These were from 1959.
Yep.
But Nazism, what people don't remember or maybe don't know, is that it actually stands for National Socialism.
In fact,
right?
those are the opening two words, National Socialismus. It's National Socialism.
There we go.
Yep.
So Nazism and communism, both were based on socialism. What was very interesting about my research in Hungary is that there's a place called the House of Terror in Budapest. And this was a building where when the Nazis occupied Hungary, they took over this place as a headquarters. And down in the basement, that's where they tortured and oppressed their political dissidents. And then when the communists came in, you know, not even a year later,
right.
they took over the House of Terror. And guess where they tortured and killed their political dissidents? I mean, both did that. You know why? Because both forms of socialism require power. You have to take power away from people in order to make socialism work. And that's what both of these parties were doing. And what's really interesting is some of the Aerocross Party, which were the Nazis, when the communists came in, all they did was they took off the Nazi uniform or the Aerocross uniform and they put on the communist uniform and
went back to work.
They went back to work. So there are people, too, that I quote in my book that say, you know, I was in the prisons of the Nazis or put into the concentration camps. When the Soviets came in, some of the same people were also put into the Soviet labor camps, the gulags. And in these people's minds, it's what I'm telling you, they're one and the same.
Right, right. Hungary has this very challenging, very troubled history. If we just look at the 20th century alone, I mean, you can go back centuries, and you have in the book, you walk people through this. But I think the lessons that you're drawing from now are sort of a a post-war Sovietization, Soviet yeah. occupation,
yeah.
And then even the first efforts of the Hungarians. So there's the Soviet occupation. They have a very important revolution. Maybe talk about that for a second in 56.
Okay.
And then they finally do break free. And there's some pretty big lessons that came out of these two pivotal events. And they really inform our intellect today.
Yeah.
They help us understand.
And actually, Chris, can I go back and talk about the lessons, the strategy lessons from our Department of Defense?
Yeah, sure.
Because this is why my book applies to Americans. And this is the main mission to me, to make Americans understand that we could lose our freedom and we need to wake up. But like I said, the Hungarians were telling me the rhetoric coming out of the U.S. reminded them of the Soviet era. So I really started walking this back and really digging into history. And if you look at the Bolshevik Revolution during that time period and the Marxism coming out of there, you see so many correlations with the issues that we are pushing, the progressives are pushing. Legalized abortion that is promoted as health care. That's the pretty covering on it.
That's seizing language.
It is also seizing language.
It's redefining.
Exactly.
Redefining things.
The other thing that the Marxists, the Bolsheviks, tried to do was to diminish parental rights. So they had more control over what the children were doing. How often do we see that this in America, especially with the transgender ideology nonsense, that parents are being cut out? I mean, we saw this woman from the teachers union just a few days ago say that parents shouldn't be able to decide what school kids are going to. And if they want to do that, that's undemocratic. That's straight out of a Marxist playbook.
Exactly. Yes. And they want to create that tension and division because it splits the fundamental building block of humanity.
Exactly.
And the fundamental building block of humanity is a family. And if they
want to control.
If they can break that up and create tension and division. And, you know, I know from my Cold War days, the party youth organization, mm-hmm. the Komsomol, they would recruit kids to report on their own parents.
Yes.
And I think you had people in Hungary telling you about...
Telling me the same things.
Right.
So to just finish this, because I want Americans to understand why I wrote this book, something else that you just alluded to, straight out of the Marxist playbook, that's going on in America today,
right.
putting division between people. We're doing it right now along the lines of gender, definitely along the lines of race and class. But Marxism did that, especially on class, the oppressed, the oppressor. We think right now of Israel and the Palestinians and how the leftists have made it so that it's not an attack by a terrorist organization against a sovereign nation. It is the oppressor and the oppressed, and they put it in this whole outlook. So the last thing I'll say, and then we can move on, but I just want people to understand is I found these 11 communist psychological warfare points in a strategy lesson written by our Department of Defense, or published by them, written by an expert on international security.
Right.
Every one of those 11 points applies to America today. They're all in my book. I want people to read them because it will open your eyes and you will start noticing when your mind is being twisted or played with. One of those is using a crisis to gain more control. What did we see with COVID?
Right.
I mean, people's freedoms and American constitutional freedoms were being stripped from them.
And
right
you can even see instances in the news where the government will run like a trial or test balloon on some latest crisis, and they get... They sort of measure whether the public is responsive to it or not.
Mm-hmm. Fear.
And it is. It's all fear as a technique.
Right.
And you know, really the sole purpose of everything that you're talking about, all these efforts at division and manipulation and propaganda, and it's really all about power, right?
It is totally about power. Another point from the communist psychological warfare points is using propaganda or building a body of people that will promote your narrative, whether it's true or not, to the unbelieving population So that they can change people's minds. And we see right now the media has become an arm of the Biden administration.
Right.
Social media, in many ways, has been an arm of the Biden administration. It's very creepy to me. Anyway, we could go through all the points, read them, because all apply.
I want to touch one more, and that is, what's your analysis, based on all your research, all your interviews, the history, the politics, the lessons and stories the Hungarians told you?
Mm-hmm.
What's your analysis of what's going on with President Trump right now?
That's an excellent question. One of the things that I learned about that happened in Hungary and in other Soviet satellite countries were these show trials. And, you know, I was in the House of Terror many times. I took a few tours. And one of the things that the Soviets did often to their political opposition or to people that they felt threatened by was put them on these trials and blame them for things. Didn't matter whether they were guilty or not. It was preposterous blame. It didn't matter. They would do it anyway. And I was confused for a second, kind of steeped in all this history. And I said to the historian, but why would the Soviets go through a mock trial? Why?
Just execute them. Just throw them in jail.
Yeah,
right?
they had the power to
get
do
it. Get it over with.
I was down in the dungeon. I saw the blood. I saw what had happened. And the historian said to me, because they could change public opinion. And I was like, light bulb went off. Oh, this is part of the mind game. And I thought about President Trump and the fact that he's been indicted 4 times.
Right.
We see what just happened out there in Colorado with him being taken off the ballot.
Right.
Talk about show trials at the max, because people with half a brain who know how to look at, you know, legal analysis, or you don't even have to do that. You can see that this is a show trial, and its purpose is to make him look like he's criminal. So.
And that means that anybody that supports him must be a
criminal also.
Right?
Yes. I mean,
so that's really the long-term goal.
Yeah.
Is to stigmatize and destroy the political opponent.
Yes.
But then also to send a message to anybody that might think like him, might act like him, might
yes.
support him.
And call them domestic terrorists.
And say, well, you're next, right?
I had no idea I was.
But I mean, but that's really it's insidious.
It's insidious, and you hit on something a few minutes ago.
Excuse me.
Fear. Fear is used by Marxism. We see that happening in the United States, throughout the world. They make you fear everything in order to cripple you and tell you what to think. I also, and we can talk about this later, but I also laid out some strategies in the last chapter of my book to fight against this, because I think that we should always take action and not just talk about the problem. And Prime Minister Viktor Orban has these 12 points of how to secure the victory of conservatism and traditional values in your country. And one of them, I just forgot what it was. It was related to... What were we talking
about? Building
your
own media, perhaps?
That wasn't the one, but that is one of his points. Build your own media. Build your own institutions. And this is all private citizens doing this
right.
that care about their country. Not talking about the government doing that. But anyway, I forgot the point, but it'll come back to me. It was about fear, right? He says, play by your own rules. This was it. In other words, don't. Is the right word cower?
Yeah.
Cower down under somebody who's trying to scare you because you believe, you know, in if it's God, if you believe in your country, you believe in the principles that this country was built on. Play by your own rules. It doesn't matter. Stand up and believe what you know is right.
I've seen disingenuous reporting, particularly criticizing CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference. CPAC yeah. Hungary is hosted in Budapest, has been for the last couple of years. You and I have both spoken there. And I've seen leftist journalists incredibly dishonestly say, well, you know, the Hungarians are being offered as the blueprint for what America should be. And I,
no.
I, you know, what I think is interesting, and you can explain this better than I can, but these are just sort of helpful ideas, right? We're not supposed to turn ourselves into Hungary, right?
It's a totally different thing. We are the blueprint for freedom.
Right.
And I'm concerned that Americans are forgetting that. That's what this book is about, to warn us what could happen if we slip into communism. Because the Hungarians have been through the communist era with the Soviet Union occupation. They know the lack of freedom there. It's a total different thing than saying another country is a blueprint for America. No, they're our colleagues. We respect them. And frankly, Prime Minister Orban has some very practical solutions, like building institutions, building your own media, standing your ground, you know, all of these different things that, yeah, I think we can learn from, because many of us in the conservative movement, you included, have been saying for a long time, we have to be more on the offense and not sit back and take everything. And that's what he's done with his country and his government. The majority of the people there are conservative, and they've just been very proactive. They put family policies in place that have increased their fertility rates, that have helped people to have more children. The abortion rate has been cut in half. Divorces are down. Marriages are higher. They've just been proactive in taking steps to really protect their country. And I'm saying, let's look at this and see what we can emulate.
Adapt it for ourselves.
Adapt it.
Right.
Yeah. I'm an American. We are the blueprint. Let's not forget that.
Right. So it's been said that Satan's greatest achievement or his greatest victory is convincing people that he doesn't exist. Mm. And everyone kind of just la-la-la goes along. And that's my position with respect to communism. Mm. Communism's greatest victory post-Cold War is to convince people that that's just something, that's something from 100 years ago. That's the Bolsheviks in 1917. Right. Hey, the Comintern was ended in 1943. The Cold War was won, depending upon when you count it, 1989 or 1991. So even saying anything about communism now is anachronistic. It is completely out of time, out of sync, out of that there is no communist threat anymore. And that's like fairy tales from history.
Yeah.
Is that the case?
It is not fairy tales from history. And I would say 5 years ago, I was one of those people that thought, yeah, there are similarities, but that sounds a little crazy to me. And then I really started getting into the research, and I'm the one beating the drum now. You should explain the Communist International a little bit more because, well, I'll let you do that.
Well, I mean, it's a result of the successful Bolshevik Revolution in the Soviet Union when they decided around 1920 to make an export version of what they had.
Right.
And they wanted to spread international communism. And so they created sort of this international league or this coordinating committee of efforts to take communism and spread it in every country they could. Hence, Communist International. They wanted to export it. It was supposedly terminated in 1943 because the Soviets, having committed atrocities and launched a war of aggression like with their Nazi allies in 1939, dividing up Poland, they found themselves in 1943 having been attacked by Germany, needing to flip.
Mm-hmm.
And FDR and Churchill reminded Stalin that while we're helping you, we really would not like you trying to destabilize our own government. So please stop if you want us to continue to support you. So that was sort of the trade-off that was done. It could easily be argued that there never was a termination of the Comintern, and it's just morphed and changed over time. And even today, we have people that are sort of limousine liberals, literally multimillionaires, who advance the most radical leftist ideas.
Yeah.
But as long as they're comfortable, they don't care.
And what I... So Communist International, its purpose was to spread the one truth. This is communism. It is their version of truth. No one under their occupation can think anything differently. Okay, you can apply that to what's going on right now in our White House, quite frankly, and the rest of the country. There are so many ways that it has spread throughout the world. And so that's why this has been such a good exercise for me to look at that history, to see the spread of the ideology. And one thing I learned that I did not understand, that even in FDR's White House, there were communist collaborators. There were communist spies. And, you know more about this than I do, but when FDR and Churchill and Stalin got together at the end of World War II to decide what was going to happen to these, to all the countries that were not the victors, they ended up giving Central Europe, like Poland, Hungary, and all these places, to the Soviet Union. But what you had referred to, I did not understand fully. Back, if you back up into 1939, Stalin and Hitler had got together. They were the ones that started the war in the first place. Correct. Later on, Russia flips. But during that time, while they were making an agreement together, they also signed the secret Hitler-Stalin Pact, is one of the names of it. And that secret pact didn't come out until the Nuremberg trials.
Yep.
That pact perfectly showed what territories Nazi Germany was going to get and what territories the Soviet Union was going to get. The irony is that Russia, you know, Germany flipped against Russia. Russia came over onto our side. But what happened at Yalta when we were so-called liberating Central Europe? We gave Russia the countries in exactly the same way that they had made this secret deal with Stalin. So the irony of that and the fact that FDR is,
complicit in all of it.
Complicit. I couldn't believe it.
All of this, you're not alone. I mean, all of this has been carefully airbrushed out of history. You're not allowed in many cases to even talk about this.
Well, it's an embarrassment.
It's forbidden history. And it's also, it is terribly embarrassing because you can ask very awkward, unpleasant questions about what people knew and when they knew it and why they agreed to certain things. So if Nazi Germany invades Poland on the 1st of September and then something like 9 days later, the Soviet Union invades Poland and they grind up this country and divide it up, that's a war of aggression.
Yes.
Yet we decide that when it comes to waging a war of aggression and charging that at Nuremberg as a war crime, we'll charge the Germans.
But not the Soviets.
But not only will we not charge the Soviets, we'll allow the Soviets to sit on the tribunal.
Yes.
Passing judgment on the Germans.
And they were war aggressors. The other thing.
I want to pause with that because what you talked about with the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact or the Hitler-Stalin Pact. This goes to Hungarian psychology. This is a big part, and you write about it in the book. That event. And then if we back up to the end of World War I, the precursor for this nightmare of World War II, one could argue that it laid the foundation for World War II. The Hungarians really were screwed at the end of World War I with something called the Treaty of Trianon, where they were double-dealed and split up. They lost most of their country, half their population.
Two-thirds of their territory. Over half their population, millions and millions of people at the end of World War I, and this is after Woodrow Wilson is saying the right to self-determination for all countries, and then they chopped up Hungary, severely weakened Hungary. Hungary, there's so many times throughout history that Hungary could have been our ally, and yet we never missed a chance to either neglect Hungary or to make it more vulnerable and weak in some way.
So, I mean, again, I want to contextualize this. So you have Trianon. Hungary loses two-thirds of its land mass. Is it half its population?
Yeah.
Then it goes into World War II.
Yeah.
And essentially gets divvied up and given back to the Soviets.
And throughout that time period, that's it's a lot to talk about today, but throughout that time period, Hungary was trying to align itself with the Allies. That's a whole other story.
And again, I'm just compressing it.
But,
and then in 56, the Hungarians have a very famous uprising.
Yes.
that was kind of baited by Radio Free Europe in the United States telling them, go ahead and do it.
But before you get to 1956, I just want to say this because it's chronological. After Yalta, where we said, sure, Soviet Union, take all the territories that you want. You know, there was this Atlantic Charter, I believe the name of it, between Churchill and FDR, that promised that the losers of the war, the countries that were being divvied up, they were going to have they were going to be supported by the Allies in establishing democracy. They were going to have free and fair elections. So Stalin was there and shook hands and signed. He had no intention.
None.
No intention. So immediately, you know, it was going on at the same time as Yalta. Soviets came in, sieged Budapest to push the Nazis out. They started burning, pillaging, raping at huge amounts as a tool of war.
Yeah.
In Hungary, we're not talking about a peaceful occupation. After Stalin shook their hands, agreed to democracy and all this, this was the beginning of terror for the Hungarians. So then if you
and
fast forward
which
to
takes
the
us
1956,
to 56, they have a revolution. They're successful for about a week.
Yeah.
They actually are able to establish themselves or throw off the initial Soviet effort to crack down.
And these were students, regular people, most of them. They were not soldiers. They were brave freedom fighters that they'd had enough for a long time.
But then the Soviets roll in.
Came back in.
And absolutely extinguish the Hungarian freedom fighters.
Yes. And as you were saying, you know, Radio Free Europe was broadcast that made it seem like the U.S. was going to come in and help them. And Hungary thought we were coming to help them.
Yeah.
And we didn't do it.
Yeah.
And we've made very lame excuses for it. It's something still on their minds today, I will tell you that.
Yeah.
Absolutely. They talk about it. They don't seem to be bitter towards us. They are a sort of part of their whole character is they don't seem to be a people that harbors bitterness. They're not stupid about it. They're not going to trust you too much, you know, if you keep rolling all over them. But they move on and get on with their lives, and they try to make the best life possible.
So a lot of interesting history, twists and turns, betrayals, double crosses, revolutions, suppression of, you know. But eventually, post-Cold War, Hungary pops out on the other side.
Yeah.
It has kind of a wobbly, I guess, early start to independence. They have a brief, you know, post-revolutionary or post-independence phase. They kind of slide into socialism again, a soft kind of squishy Euro-socialism. But then this guy, Viktor Orban, comes back about 12 years ago.
Right. Well, what had happened in the beginning is Prime Minister Viktor Orban was actually one of the freedom fighters at the end that pushes the Soviet Union out by standing firm, by starting a party called Fidesz, and by just garnering a lot of support. So he was a lot of the reason of that. And I forget exactly who was elected the first time in free and fair elections. But what happened is, for like the first decade, I believe, the people that came to power were what I call reinvented communists, because all of a sudden, these people who had been with the communists, all of a sudden, they had new resumes, basically, that said they were freedom fighters.
Brush up the resume and resubmit it.
Yeah, so, you know, some of them got into power, and what happened is Hungary continued to go deeper and deeper in debt. There was no progress, there was little freedom, and the people said, enough. And like I said, I forget exactly how it happened. Prime Minister Viktor Orban was elected, and there was a time period there where he was not in office, but currently, he just won last year his fourth consecutive victory. It was a landslide victory. And there's a whole economic synopsis there, a summary in my book about how they are today, the difference between their economics coming out of the social era and how much they're prospering now and why and the policies that they've put forth. So it's quite a difference.
And you've got all these stats in here. You did an economic analysis.
I did.
So people that are interested in that can find that information here as well. There's three issues here and now that I think it's interesting because it's a part of it is a current U.S. public policy debate. But the Hungarian example on these issues can provide us, I think, a little glimmer of how to go forward. But there's three issues that make Hungary the bane of the Biden administration and the European Union. Hit those three issues and let us know what the big takeaway there is.
Well, at least on the first two, conservatives are going to be cheering for Hungary. Because with all this transgender nonsense coming in through the EU, Hungary stood up and said no to the transgender ideology being taught to their children in schools, being shown to them publicly. I don't know exactly how it works, but even on the television, if they're going to show things about transgender ideology, it has to be at certain hours. There has to be a disclaimer on it so that parents know to move their kids. But the main thing is you cannot teach it to kids in the school.
Now, folks don't realize, the European Union has a whole school curriculum, K through 12, developed for LGBTQIA++.
And they want Hungary to use it.
And so they demand it, really.
Demand it.
That Hungary buy into the whole gender ideology.
Yes.
Weirdness.
Not only do they demand it, Chris, but they have held back billions of dollars from Hungary because they won't do it. They have also called Hungary a backslider of democracy. They cannot call Hungary a democracy any longer because they don't uphold human rights. Now, you and I have been to Hungary. We've seen gay guys there together. Nobody cares.
Nobody cares.
All they're saying is the parents there. In fact, they did a national referendum. The parents got together and agreed overwhelmingly. They don't want teaching this transgender nonsense to their children. They understand, imagine, that young people are impressionable and need guidance, and the parents want to do it themselves.
Right.
It has nothing to do with, as the EU calls Hungary, being LGBT haters. Nothing. There's nothing. You can be LGBT there. Nobody cares.
All right, so there's the militant, the militant gender ideology stuff that Hungary said, no, parents are in charge of education.
Yeah.
Parents will protect their kids. We're not buying into your agenda.
Yeah.
That's one issue. What's the second issue?
The second one, hot button issue, is illegal immigration. I mean, they've had the audacity to put barriers up around the country and not allow a mass influx of illegal immigrants. Can you imagine that? I wish Biden would do the same thing. If you go back to the time of the Arab uprising, the EU basically, you know, when Germany had invited everybody into Europe, just like Biden has done into our country.
Right.
And people were flowing and flowing by the millions after a few years. And Hungary was trying to do their part. They were allowing people to come in Hungary to go to other parts of Europe.
The geography is such that Hungary is essentially the southern border of the European Union. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the Schengen Agreement. You have to get into Hungary to get into Europe.
Right.
I guess you can go around it. You can go to Italy or someplace. But Hungary was geographically positioned that it had enormous flows of people.
Yes. And they were trying to take them in and send them off. They were registering them. And
right.
You go to 2015, it was like 40,000 they had taken in like the first month or something. By September, it was like 400,000, and they declared a state of emergency. They said, this is ridiculous. We're neglecting our own people. We can't do this. And they started putting up borders.
Fencing.
Fencing is the right word.
Yeah.
along the borders. And the EU is mad because the EU wants everybody to take a certain amount of migrants. Hungary is like, no. And here's the thing, Chris, especially after the attack of Hamas on Israel, you know, we have seen terrorism rise all through Europe. You and I were over in Central Europe during this time. Right. And guess where there is no rise in terrorism? There's no terrorism at all.
Hungary.
Right. And Poland, who have not allowed this crazy illegal
Poland's
immigration.
Poland's about to slide off the edge into its own weirdness.
Well, pray not. But, you know, it's very, very practical. It's taking care of your nation first. That's what they believe. Hungary first.
And just also
like
for the
America
record,
first.
Hungary's not against legal immigration.
No.
They just oppose illegal
Imagine that.
Immigration.
Isn't
so
that
if you
common
wanna,
sense?
If you want to go to Hungary and you make your application and you say, I want to resettle, they'll evaluate it. And
well, Chris, you and I were in the Ukrainian refugee center in Hungary last year.
That's true.
Where they were taking in all these people. 3.5 million people have come through there. Most of them have gone on to other places, but they have resettled many of the Ukrainians in Hungary.
Which brings us to point number three.
Ukraine.
So one was the crazy gender ideology
right.
being rammed down their throats. The illegal second was they don't want illegal immigration.
Right.
And the third issue is the Ukrainian war.
It is the Ukrainian war. Again, like I said, they're open to Ukraine's sovereignty. They've been taking care of the Ukrainian refugees. But they said no to the Western sanctions. In fact, they got a waiver in the European Union for it simply because the sanctions against Putin would have crushed Hungary's economy. I mean, if you think about the crisis, the energy crisis, that Europe has been through
right.
since the sanctions. You translate that to a small, landlocked country whose infrastructure, energy infrastructure, is mostly Soviet era, coming from Russia. You can understand, you know, they are taking steps to diversify, but they were like, we can't do this as quickly as the EU wants us to. And so, no. And again, they had a referendum. The people said no to sanctions, not because they agree with Putin. They don't want Putin in Ukraine.
And even when you say sanctions, what you're talking about is gas and oil.
Gas and oil. That's exactly right.
They need
right.
fuel to run the country.
Yes.
No fuel, no economy, no country.
Right? No country, no people.
Right. So what they really needed was a break on getting fuel into the country.
That was it.
They're landlocked. They don't yes. have a port. All their infrastructure was built during the Soviet era.
Yes.
So there's a high, like super high dependency.
Or at least most of it. Yeah, and I'm sorry.
No, I say, and the other thing they're not too hot on is sending weapons into Ukraine.
Yes, that's exactly right.
What's the thinking behind that?
Well, you know, I had the privilege of meeting with Prime Minister Viktor Orban a couple of times, but one of the times the discussion was around this. And you know that over 400,000 Ukrainians have died. If you look at the news in Central Europe, like you and I do, not the propaganda you get from the U.S., you see that Ukraine's not doing so well. The counteroffensive is not working. They have had horrific casualties during the counteroffensive because Russia took time, set up these in-depth systems, right, defense systems against the counteroffensive. And this word horrific, I got from Wall Street Journal or New York Times. I mean, this is not just me saying this. So they're very concerned that, like I believe, Russia is just going to devastate Ukraine. And they're calling for peace and ceasefire and peace negotiations, just like I and Counterpoint Institute have. In fact, I had an article come out today in Real Clear Politics that outlines exactly what I'm talking about here, but with respect to America's interests in this, because I believe we've gone way beyond our interests as well.
And I think the article is, will your sons and daughters fight in Central Europe?
Yes, because you know what? Secretary Lloyd Austin, Secretary of Defense, just said about a week ago that if Congress does not pass this extra $60 billion for Ukraine, that most likely our troops, our sons and daughters, are going to be fighting in Central Europe soon. And it really made me mad because at the same time, we had Zelensky over here asking for money. and saying that the debate in Congress at the time, which is, we need to fund our border. Well, we need money for Ukraine. We really need to close our borders. He categorized that debate as something that was just inspiring Putin, and it just made me mad.
Do the Hungarians have any experience with Ukrainians?
A lot of experience. And before I do that, let me just finish with this.
Sure.
What we have already given to Ukraine is the largest foreign assistance package that we have given since the end of World War II in the Marshall Plan. So you have to put this in context.
Right.
And yes, I think I'll let you explain that about Hungary and Ukraine.
I just think it's worth pointing out that, you know, so most Americans can't find Ukraine on a map,
mm-hmm.
right? So there's a lot of hysterical rhetoric and a lot of arm flapping and drama, you know, Twitter wars and
flags and
all kinds of
yeah.
hysterical. But most Americans have no idea where Ukraine is.
True.
They certainly don't know what the Donbass is. Vivek Ramaswamy humiliated the war hawk, Nikki Haley, about he said, name three provinces. There's four, but name three involved in the Russian invasion. So there's a lot of hysterical rhetoric.
Right.
There's a hell of a lot of money involved.
Mm-hmm.
But most Americans are, frankly, clueless.
True.
But Hungary actually shares a border
yeah.
with Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. And there are actually ethnic Hungarians in Ukraine, some of which were put there because of the Treaty of Trianon. So Hungarians are dying by the thousands as well, these
right.
ethnic Hungarians.
So they actually have some skin in the game.
They have skin in the game.
Right. So that kind of changes the perspective.
Agreed.
And they have a different approach, probably worth at least examining, even if you don't want to agree with it. At least examine it and hear it out and weigh it. And once you familiarize yourself with the facts,
yeah.
then you can make a decision. But there isn't a lot of that going on. There's no real dialogue.
Yeah.
There isn't even a call for peace treaty.
Isn't that strange?
I mean, one would think that somewhere in the U.S. administration, someone would say, you know what we need to do? How about for Christmas?
Yeah.
Let's have a Christmas ceasefire.
Mm-hmm.
And let's have some talks. And if it's the middle of January and we still hate each other, we can go back to killing each other. But for the next 2 weeks,
let's talk about it.
Let's just calm it down and open up a dialogue.
Don't you think that's odd?
But you don't hear
anybody,
a single public official, even suggesting it.
Well, do you know what Representative Paul Gosar has said?
What has Paul Gosar said?
He said he believes, undoubtedly, that is because of the financial ties that Joe Biden has to Ukraine. It's not something I know, yes or no, but it's food for thought.
Well,
you've
he has reason
ask.
To say that, right?
He does.
Yeah.
You got to ask the question.
Dr. Shea Bradley Farrell, you've written a tremendous book, Last Warning to the West. It's not just doom and gloom and scary stories and
yeah.
provocations, right?
Right.
There's a lot of books out there where people just try to scare the hell out of people.
No.
You tell an interesting story, centuries long, but it's very fast, and it's fun to read. What did you enjoy most about writing this book? What was your, aha, I did it, or I got it, or what did you really enjoy?
Well, you know, I went over there to Hungary and spent a few months altogether collecting historical data, statistics, all that. But the most fun part was the people I interviewed. I got to interview senior government officials. It was wonderful. But I also got to interview students, university students. So bright, these kids. I got to go out into the country and interview people out there, just regular people, bus drivers, accountants, some people from the small town where Viktor Orban grew up. And, you know what, they just became dear to my heart. So their stories are in here, too, woven in. One of the gentlemen two gentlemen that I was able to interview were both children during the occupation of the Soviets, when the Soviets rolled into Budapest. You know, unfortunately, both of them recounted, you know, at different times to me that they watched the women in the basement where they were hiding be raped and raped and raped by the soldiers. But they were such good and kind people that spoke to me. And one of them, I said, well, you remember when the Soviets rolled out in 1991, 1990-91, what was the first thing you thought? And he said it was the absence of fear. He didn't have to live his life in fear. He'd lived his entire life knowing that whatever they were doing in the family would be watched. They had to keep it on the down low. When they went to school, they said and did something entirely different than they did at home. They had to take their religious symbols down off the walls, put up the pictures of the communist leaders. And it was the absence of fear. And he is not a bitter person. He was a very intelligent, kind person. And their stories just meant so much to me. And so I guess I'll leave you with this story. Out in the country, one of the gentlemen, I would say probably around 45, 50 years old, looked at me, and they had been explaining to me, this group of people, that they looked to the U.S. during the time of Reagan. They love Reagan. And they looked to us as this beacon of hope and what freedom and prosperity and family could look like. And this big, burly guy said to me with tears in his eyes, and he said, "Is there hope for America? Because they love America. Is there hope?" And, you know, nobody can cry without me crying with them. So I got choked up, and I said, yes, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing if there wasn't hope. At the root of American people, we're freedom fighters. We're just like you in that. We fight for our freedom. And we just need to wake up our people. Awake to the reality is one of the parts of a chapter in here. Awake to the reality of what's going on.
One of the best endorsements, there's a bunch of great endorsements in this book. Tucker Carlson, General Michael Flynn, Congressman Gosar. But Lou Dobbs gives a great line here. He says, "Marxist Dems, big corporate media, and the Davos crowd will hate this book. That's reason enough to buy Dr. Shea Bradley Farrell's book. We must heed her warning and win the America First mission."
Yeah.
And that's really what you come away from. You give people strategies, and you give them ideas and practical ways to take a lot of lessons of defeating communism and march it into the present right now.
Yeah. To defeat progressivism, because just progressivism, communism, they're almost exactly the same thing.
Right.
You know, even Viktor Orban said progressivism, you know, during the Soviet occupation, we already had all this progressivism in universities, the CRT, these things. It was all very similar to what was being pushed on them. And they're like, we've already done this. It doesn't work. We're going to move on now and take care of our nation.
Well, this is literally the title of the book, Last Warning to the West, Hungary's Triumph Over Communism and the Woke Agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Shea Bradley Farrell, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you so much.
Chris,
can I say you can get the book on Amazon right now?
Absolutely.
You get it in a day or two. And the other thing is,
there's an e-version. People can
get it.
There's
an e-version.
Instantly.
Yeah, that's right. And also, I'd love for your followers to sign up for our newsletter at counterpointinstitute.org. It's only a couple of times a month, but we'll send you the latest on the book and also on the other issues that we're working on.
Where can people follow you on social media?
It's at Dr. Shea underscore DC, at Counterpoint DC. That's on Twitter, and it's similar on Instagram.
Great. Well, if you don't own this book, you're wrong. So go out and get yourself a copy. We appreciate you coming in and having a really fascinating discussion, stuff people don't know and they should know. And you really should be very proud of your work. Excellent job.
Thank you very much. Merry Christmas, and thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. I'm Chris Farrell, on Watch.